That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said. Well, that's what she said.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the latest edition of That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. My guest today, Mike Wise, senior writer for The Undefeated. Really great conversation. Incredibly honest and open. He had quite an unusual upbringing. A lot of difficulties with his parents and with an uncle. And a lot of the troubles that he went through as a kid, he says, inspired him to be outspoken about those issues later in life, to push back on them, to be curious, to fight for people, and to use them as sort of an inspiration to move forward in his journalism and in stories that he tells. So I really appreciate him coming on and really being open about how he became who he is. And his role on The Undefeated is fascinating to me, too. A white male on a site about race, where most of his coworkers at The Undefeated are African-American and are speaking to issues that affect them every day, and how that how people treat him in that role, and also how The Undefeated has sort of found its footing in its first year after a difficult start under the tutelage of Jason Whitlock, and eventually transferred over to a new editor-in-chief and then took off. So it's a really great conversation, and I hope you guys enjoy it. That's coming up next.
That's what she said.
More That's What She Said in just a second. But first, I want to hear from you. Whether this is your first time listening or you've been listening for a while, let me know how I'm doing. Tell me who you want to hear from, what guests would be great. You can always tweet me at Sarah Spain on Twitter and let me know. You can always leave a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. That's super helpful to me. Helps bump up the interest in my podcast if you leave a rating and a review. And if you like what you hear, make sure you're subscribed so that I'm easy to find the next time you're looking. If you subscribe on the ESPN app, you can even get an alert whenever there's a new episode. So tell me what you think, guys. Would love to hear from you.
That's what she said.
Happy now to welcome ESPN senior writer at The Undefeated, Mike Wise. Formerly of the Washington Post for quite some time, 10 years, right? And a radio host also for several years down there. And now intersects with my life at ESPN quite a bit via, you know, coming on my radio shows and reading all sorts of stuff on The Undefeated. And you have known people like my former co-host Jane McManus for years and have been in the industry for years. But it was only recently that we got to spend time together. So I'm happy to have you on and get to know you a little bit better. I'm starting with a random thing that came out when I was kind of looking into your background. And I had never heard this before. So tell me about when you almost drowned and the relationship that came out of that.
So in 2008, I was taking a jog run outside Washington in Georgetown along the Fino Canal, which is a kind of borders the Potomac River. It goes from, Ohio to Washington. And at any rate, I'm going out 6 miles, and I'm taking my golden lab with me. And it's dark, so there's hardly anybody on the trail. I can't even remember. And so we get to this turnaround point where I did a little stretching, and all of a sudden my dog goes down by the water. And truth be told, there I threw a stick down there so she would get a drink. I didn't realize, you know, this was the middle of January in 2008. The canal was pretty much frozen over. So the next thing I know, I turn around after I'm stretching, and she's in the middle of the canal on the ice, and I'm going, oh no, this is not good. And I start calling her. Her name's Luli. And I said, Luli, Luli. Boom. Within a second, it was like a movie. The ice breaks. She goes through. She's whimpering. She can't get out. Every time she tries to put her paws up on the ice, she slips off or the ice barely breaks and she can't get up. And it's like a good 2 minutes, 3 minutes is going by, and I'm starting to realize she's probably not getting out. So I'm panicking. I'm thinking, all right, what's the worst that can happen? I don't think the thing is more than 6 feet deep. Maybe I watched too many of these Discover channels, but I started lowering my body onto the ice thinking if I distribute my weight, like they say, you can go very far across the ice. And I almost get to her, Sarah, and I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute, I'm 200 plus, she's 65. What are the boom? I go, whoosh, the thing breaks, I go through. Now we're like two holes in the ice, about 2 yards from each other. and I finally break the ice between us, and we're just sitting here, and I start realizing I can't stand up. And then I try to get on the ice, and I keep trying to get on top of the ice, and it breaks a little bit, but I never get a firm grip. And finally, I use my arm, my right arm, like a fish hook, put it under her belly, and just jerk as hard as I can with everything I had left. And she somehow got on a piece of ice that was thick enough to hold her. She scrambles up the bank. It wasn't a Lassie story at all. She did not wait for me or go get somebody. She just shook off and started running down the trail as if, go, die, I'm fine.
Right.
At any rate, so she starts to come back. She's scared to go down. And I'm looking at her from the trail, and there's this moment where I'm starting to lose feeling in my lower extremities because hypothermia is starting to set in. And I'm starting to panic, and at that moment I'm realizing, I don't know how she's going to get home tonight. And in that instant, I started blood-curdling scream at the top of my lungs, help, help. I'm thinking, you know, this is doom. There's nobody out here. And I can't say it was 90 seconds where I just saw this sort of body emerging from the mist, and he lowers himself down, asks what I'm doing in there. I think, you know, I'm either part of the polar bear club or I'm trying to kill myself. I said,
right.
I said, believe it or not, my
dog
fell in.
Do you want help?
My dog fell in. I went and got her and did it. And you can see that she's all caked on ice and frozen and, you know, and he starts lowering his body into the ice close to the shore, close to the little, the bank where you can pull yourself up. And he gets about into his waist. And he's trying to get there, and I'm like, oh, God, I get, you know, when I'm good about 10 yards away, all of a sudden I lunge, and I can touch the bottom. I'm thinking, I'm living. I'm not going to die.
Wow.
And he actually helps me, pulls me up the bank. I just sat there for a minute. He goes, are you okay? I'll go call somebody. I go, that's all right. I think once I, you know, there's a bathroom up here. I'll get warm. You should get on your way, start running. He goes, all right. And as he took off, I said, what's your name? And he said, Jason, and Jason Coates. And I said, what do you do? Where do you work? And he goes, I'm a student at GW Law School. So I just remember that in my head. And it's me and the dog. And, oh, I forget. I passed over the moment where I basically went up in the fetal position and bawled my eyes out, thinking I was almost dead.
Right.
But after that, I sort of.
But
you know,
he just left.
Long,
he wasn't worried about
longer,
you?
I end up getting in touch with the guy.
Huh.
And he asked me. 2 years ago, he asked me to marry him. So I became a minister for a day. I married he and his wife. We ended up he's now the proud father of two twins. We're completely opposite. He's like this introverted policy guy that works for the nonprofit. He's so smart. And I'm this loud, obnoxious person that my wife tells me to shut up routinely. And so the bottom line is he's really become a big part of my life. And, It's one of those stories that ended happily and could have not ended happily.
Yeah. Long story short, in between the time that he saved you and disappeared and you married him, I presume there were phone conversations or letters or something that made him feel that you were the person that was meant to marry them.
Yeah, I think what happened was they just started. I mean, when I had the radio show, I brought him on the radio show once, Sarah, and I basically, because he was such a nice guy, though he's introverted, I said, hey, we're going to get it. I'm going to tell everybody that you're a hero today because it was the anniversary of him pulling me out.
Yeah.
But I said, no, yeah, you saved my life, but we're going to get you a date today. And he was so shy, and I felt guilty about it later. And then I actually met his girlfriend at the time, and they came to my son's birthday party. And so when I'm like, I'm marrying him, not this part, I'm marrying him, and I'm realizing, okay, don't make this about you, make this, but he definitely wants in there, like, you know, before I tell you the story of how Jason and Alex met, I'm going to tell you how Jason and I met. When I got to that, I looked at my wife, who's got my son, and another son's on the way, and I'm like, oh, this is even possible. And I had to hold it together, and
yeah.
It wasn't until after I got done with the ceremony, which went great, I walked out of this little place in Miami, Coconut Grove, and I was like, same thing, bawled my eyes out like a baby.
It's
you know what? He's just not only a hero, but even if the guy didn't, even if he never pulled me out, I would have loved to have known him because he's such a good person, and he's one of these people that gets it, you know, so.
And I'm glad that you didn't turn into, I don't know if you remember the Chuck Palahniuk book called Choke, where the con man convinces people all over that they've saved him from dying and then starts getting letters and then eventually cons them out of money years later when he's on hard times. And he does the bit to everybody in different restaurants by pretending to be choking. So I'm glad that you did not.
Believe it or, that's awful, but believe it or not, you saved my life as well, Sarah. And I'd like I'd like to cash in. I've never seen that. That's a crazy story.
Yeah.
But anyway, So that was. It's funny that story was more read in the Washington Post than any of my provocative columns that I thought was.
Of course. Truth is stranger than fiction, right? And things that come up like that have like happy endings, but are kind of crazy stories. People are fascinated by that stuff. All right. So tell me about. Early Mike Weiss.
The dog's okay too. She's 12 now.
Still alive. I love that. Yeah. Didn't stick around for you, but you managed to find her. She didn't go far.
No. She came back, and the funny thing is, on the way back that night, I started jogging again, trying to get warm, and she wouldn't leave my heel for an inch. She was so scared of falling in.
Yeah.
So it was sort of like she was scared than I was, I think. But anyway.
So let's talk about young Mike. I saw that you were born in Napa and grew up in Hawaii. So how much time did you spend in Napa before moving?
So we lived up and down the Bay Area. My dad, God rest his soul, was a drinking, carousing newspaper man, should I say. He worked for the San Jose Mercury News for a while and drank himself out of that job and was up and down the Bay Area. And then on a lark, while he was, I guess in recovery, my stepmother and him decided we're going to move to Hawaii one day when I was 12 and my sister was 10. And literally we took off in our VW bus. They thought they were hippies. We loaded our VW bus, shipped it over and met it and, basically lived on the beach for the first 2 months we were there. And I told my dad, I'm in sixth grade. Why aren't I in school? And he said, it's life experience.
Oh, boy.
And all of a sudden, like, eventually he got a job as a copy editor of the Hollywood Star Bulletin and he, he'd been sober for a long time. And then he, like, crazy enough, went into the Episcopal Seminary later on. But bottom line is, yeah, I grew up around this crazy sort of flower child era in California. And I didn't experience any of the joys of Napa and wine and all that until I got back years later and I could afford actually to go tasting.
Yeah, too young to like it if you moved when you were 12. I love Napa. It's one of my happy places. And I love Hawaii.
That's awesome.
So I have cousins who grew up in Hawaii, and they're into dance and music, and they're very free-spirited. Are you surprised that you ended up in, deciding, first of all, to go to college on the mainland at Fresno State, because a lot of people never want to leave Hawaii, and that you ended up in a career that's much more straightforward than maybe some of those that are more free-spirited from the islands?
Sure. No, Hawaii, I mean, it's funny. I haven't been back since a high school reunion a while ago, about over 10 years now, but it's still got a special place in my heart. It's like where the weirdest thing was we didn't grow up in Hawaii, like, it was like Eva Beach. We're talking rural area. Now there's golf courses, but used to be just be sugar cane fields. And I'll tell you, if anybody hasn't been to Hawaii in the very rural part, as a white person, you're a minority. And a lot of the Samoan, Tongan, Filipino kids, Hawaiian kids, they're told by their parents, you took their land. And, while I hated that for several years, and I started playing basketball, and it kind of gave me an into that world, and I was accepted, I think everybody should be on the other side of the fence once in their life, because it really does show you how the world works when you're not the majority. And I'm glad for that experience. I still have lifelong friends there. But, yeah, it's weird. The Hawaii lifestyle, it's the best thing in the world. I mean, you just kick back, you drink Mai Tais and pina coladas, and you wait for good food to come to you. And I guess I couldn't make it as a fire eater or a hula dancer, so therefore I went into journalism. And I just remember I tried to play college basketball, but I was really bad. I played at Hawaii Pacific for a year, and then at American River College, a junior college, and I was like, okay, I just got to get my journalism degree. And then I just started working at these small newspapers. And, would I have liked to get back to Hawaii? Yeah, but shoot. I knew that the best media institutions in the world were on the East Coast. And, and I talked myself into getting to one. So pretty much was if I was going to stay in that profession, I pretty much had to be where the jobs were.
Sounds like your father kind of cleaned up his act in time to have a good relationship with him, I presume. Or was there resentment over the drinking, especially when you were younger?
No, that's a good question. I mean, I'm not one of these people that had a complicated relationship with my dad. I knew what it was. He was my hero from about 0 to 4, and then from about 4 to maybe 15, you know, he was this drunk guy that I really didn't like. And then from 15 on, he became a real, a person of stature to me. And that I really, you know, he had so many flaws, but he was very good to me. And the only time, you know, I will say this, I'll go deep with you on this. I had a broken engagement in about 2004, and I can't tell you how many times, how I screwed it up and how I wasn't ready for it and all the things I did to mess it up and self-sabotage. But I can tell you that I was really angry at my dad after that, because I just felt like he just gave me bad messages about relationships. Like, they were always going to hold me back, and he just never, like, warmed up to anybody I went out with or anything. And it wasn't until after I got married that he really realized, you know what, I was wrong. I was the one who was scared, you know, always scared of committing to someone. I should have never gave you. But for a couple of years after the breakup of the game, I didn't even talk to him. I was so angry, and I just felt like, you know, Dad, I didn't need to see the skirt chasing. I didn't need to see the womanizing. I didn't need to see the drunken carousingness. I didn't need to see how you treated my mom. But, you know, he got better, and I realized a lot of it was the disease of alcoholism. It wasn't him.
Yeah, because it's interesting to follow in his sort of career footsteps if there was some tension there. But if it's part of the world that you grew up in when he was heroic to you, or at least the way he raised you was to be curious and interested in journalism in that way, I guess then that trumps the personal issues.
I think you're right. You're right. And he was sort of in that, like, at the San Jose Mercury News, he had a pretty cool career. Like, he covered one of the nation's first heart transplants, and did a series about a bunch of serial murders at one point. But then he would do stuff like, he would be covering the city council, and he would punch a Santa Clara city councilman at some cocktail party that he didn't like. Or he actually threatened people with a machete on the desk of the Mercury News. If they cut his story, he was going to cut them to pieces.
Boy.
And this is something that Human Resources today would go nuts with, and we would have CNN, a man with a machete is in the Washington Post. Back then, like, they just sent him home and said, Roger's drinking again. He'll be back tomorrow.
Yikes. Imagine that now. Yeah, imagine that now.
But there's times when I wish I had that machete still. I could wield it against some of my editors.
Right. Or at least have it up on the wall in your office as a sort of warning to any who might enter, right? Might be a little more subtle. What did your mother do?
My mom passed away a long time ago. She was, my father met her in Germany when she was like 15 or 16. And she was like 24. And so she got pregnant with me when she was 16. So.
Oh, wow. So they started dating. Yeah, so it was illegal.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it was basically statutory rape. And I only found out about that later. But at any rate, she didn't speak a word of English when she came to California to live with my grandparents while she was pregnant with me. And my father was finishing up his military service over there. And so, my mom, she was she's a really good person. She never really had a profession. She had a hard time over here, and they got divorced when I was 6, and eventually she went back to Germany. And so I didn't really reconnect with her until later in life, about 2 years before she died. And so it's not the greatest story in the world. But you know what? One of the things that happened was she remarried and had a son over there. And I have, like, this German half-brother who I'm really close with. He comes and visits in our family, and, you know, it's one of those things that she left behind that I can remember her by.
How old were you when she passed?
I was 29, 30.
Spent a lot of time with her after the divorce, and it was an easy choice for you to go live with your father as opposed to her?
Well, I mean, I won't go into all the details, but, you know, she sort of went back to Germany when I was 6 and my sister was 4, and she had some other problems beyond just the marriage. And, the bottom line was, you know, so while we got calls and she's visited us a couple times, when we moved to Hawaii, I didn't see her from 12 to 27. So I really didn't, I never saw her for 15 years. So
yeah,
that was kind of weird. And, you know, and it left a void and probably led to a lot of different things in life that, that I had to, deal with later on. But the bottom line is I was just, she was kind of out of sight, out of mind. It wasn't until I reconnected with her that I realized what I really missed. And
yeah,
that's what I was certain. You know, anybody that's, you know, close or not close to their mom, don't tell them they don't want their mom in their life, because everybody wants their mom in their life.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting too. I have a friend whose father met her mother. She had originally come over to the States during the war with an American. They got divorced, and then she met my friend's dad. And it was the same thing, where she was much closer with her father, who was this man of letters and very smart. And her mother was, despite years in the States, was never really super proficient in English. And they just never connected the same way, because she grew up an American kid and just didn't feel a connection to her mother's culture the same way. And I think that can be really complicated if specifically if they come over just as a bride without a career.
Yeah, I think that was part of it, Sarah. But I also think, I mean, my dad was just, he was a train wreck at that time in life. So basically, this is crazy, but my sister and I would sleep in the back of the station wagon at the Mercury News.
Oh,
and
wow.
My grandparents would come pick us up the next day. So we lived off and on with our grandparents who lived up in Napa. And, you know, my grandmother especially provided us with real stability for a few years. And she was like a lifesaver in our lives in many ways. And some of my father's brothers and sisters, my aunts and uncles they kind of looked after us too. But yeah, I mean, it wasn't until later that he really got himself together. So yeah, I mean, if I had my druthers, I probably would have went with my mom, but you know, you're a kid, you don't know what's going on. Everybody's telling you where to go and what to do. And you just sort of like, you roll with it.
Yeah, at that age for sure. So do you think that you were, despite all of this, a pretty typical kid through high school? I mean, to go on and go to Fresno State and work at the New York Times and the Post, I mean, you are incredibly accomplished, and not everybody whose story starts out like yours is adjusted enough to have those things figured out at the normal age. Usually, maybe there's a stunted growth for a while before coming back around and finding your way. Did you feel pretty much like you had a reasonable, normal high school despite all that?
I think what happens to anybody that's had a dysfunctional family or, you know, dealt with parental abandonment, I think what happens is, and this is not just, you either go two ways. You go down a really bad path, and I know there were forks in the road that I had where I could have went there, or you basically you're in denial about where you came from and what you're really about until probably later in life, and you're in denial, and you're telling yourself everything's normal, and you're outwardly projecting this image of, oh, I'm great. Hey, I come from a great family. Yeah, we're like the Kennedys, but with less money. Like, no, you're not actually. You're more like closer to the Tonya Harding's family and out of a trailer park. But you don't tell anybody that. So you go, you know, what do they say? Fake it till you make it. And so I just kept going on along with this. I would never tell anybody this story. I was afraid and I was embarrassed and I was, I didn't want to tell anybody my mom left us. I didn't want to tell anybody my dad was a drunk. I didn't want to tell anybody that my family was screwed up in 20 different ways. I just wanted to believe that I came from a normal relationship, and really sports helped that. I mean, I was a good high school basketball player. Of course, that was in Hawaii, and that's like being, you know, that's like being a good football player in Iceland. It doesn't matter, you know? And so, but at any rate, I think sports got me out of it. And, you know, I will say this, and I'm sure you've dealt with this in your own life, Sarah, is like things that happen to you in life, whether it's awful sexism, whether it's awful racism, whether it's misogyny, all that stuff. Like it's sort of in a weird way, it's kind of a jujitsu thing where you use that negative force and you propel it outside of you. And like I look at, like, I could have never done a story about Gilbert Arenas and finding his mom on the streets in Miami and trying to figure out his life. If that never happened to me, I wouldn't have the same feeling about it. So So I think for me anyway, that was a way of sort of, in a weird way, I picked these stories that are cathartic for me because they help me fix the holes in my own life.
Yeah.
That sounds wild.
No. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think some people are crushed by the things that go wrong, and other people, like you said, can find ways to propel them forward and use those things to either help others in similar situations or to at least be curious about those situations in the world. Since you mentioned it, I don't know if it's something you talk about often, but was it hard for you to decide to talk about the abuse in your past when the Penn State scandal came out, or did you feel like it was like a necessity, like you said, cathartic to get it out?
I think that for me was, at the time I did it last September when they were celebrating Paterno and all the players were coming back, and I really felt like the victims of Sandusky and essentially what amounted to a cover-up at Penn State and resulted in jail sentences and convictions for several school officials, was I just bothered by me, like nobody thought of these people. And so I think I'd wanted to write that story 4 years before when I was at Sandusky's trial covering it for the Post. And I was like, I'm 10 yards away from this guy and I just want to freaking choke him out.
Yeah.
And all this anger came out. And then I saw these kids like that were 25 and probably, you know, 8, 12 and 13 when he molested them. And they're sitting there telling their stories, weeping on this and how, you know, this, what it did to their lives. And I'm like, man, these guys are using what happened to them to put this guy away so he doesn't hurt other kids. Like, how awesome is that?
Right.
And I started looking at it from a different perspective from that point on. And so I really did whatever, you know, healing work that you say that happens with those kind of things. I feel like I did a lot of that privately. But now I was sort of like, you know what, I'm ready to just say it happened to me because, you know, I'm not shameful about it anymore. I don't have guilt asking why it happened to me, why it was an uncle in my family that turned out to be a serial pedophile and ended up on Megan's Law's list. And was, a registered sex offender and passed away a couple of years ago. But I wanted to let people know that you know, the families that, if not look the other way, show willful ignorance in these kinds of things, man, we got to stop this as families.
Yeah.
I know it's a taboo subject, but, you know, these people shouldn't be invited back to Thanksgiving.
Right.
Until at least they make amends or they show they're in some kind of program where they're not going to, you know, go into the recidivist area,
yeah,
area and do this again. Because, you know what, anybody that knows now, I mean, shoot, California border law where it doesn't matter if a family member, if you know, you could get a year misdemeanor for not telling.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's like that old, you know, what is it? The, you know, that old Elie Wiesel line,
yeah,
the Holocaust survivor,
yeah,
the Nobel Peace Laureate. He had a great line once. He said, the opposite of love isn't hate. It's indifference.
Yeah.
If you don't care about something, man, that, and something like that, then you're as big a problem as almost the person perpetrating it.
Yeah, we actually say we kind of have come back to that a fair amount on the trifecta when talking about domestic violence, sexual assault on campus, et cetera, that because people accuse our show of having an agenda because it's women talking about these issues. And I always say just abiding by the status quo is as much of an agenda as pushing back against it. You just being okay with these things is as bad. You know, it's a choice just as much as being against it. And so you're right. And
yes.
I do think that people are speaking out more than ever, and hearing other people's stories kind of empowers other people and has allowed us to have better and more rich conversations about how to stop it and how to get better. So you're a part of that. And that's incredibly important.
And you know what's awesome is you are, too. But when players actually call on other players for
it. Oh, yeah.
That
huge.
To me is so powerful. It's
mm-hmm.
so powerful and affirming about, like, yeah, you won't stand for this. And irrespective of, like, this guy's your teammate and you've bonded with him in different ways, there's some things that you can't look past. And when players get to that point, it makes society get to that point. And I don't know, I feel like that to me is more empowering than everything. And I'd be remiss, too. I don't want to throw a bunch of blue ribbons around this, but, you know, when you write a story like that, child sexual abuse, you know, you're scared what's going to come back from your editors or the company. And the worst, I knew I wrote a good piece, and I wouldn't have even said anything if they wouldn't have come back to me and said, hey, we like this, but we don't know if this is the venue for it. You know, maybe you could write this for a survivor's blog. But, man, the first, you know, my editor is named Steve Reese. The first thing he does is he calls me up and he goes, are you okay after writing it? And I was like, wow. Like, and then the company president, our boss, John Skipper, calls me up next day and he goes, how you doing? Like,
yeah.
And all of a sudden it was this great wall of support and realized, wow, for a freaking multinational conglomerate, you realize all of a sudden that the business, this corporation, this 7,000-person employee operation is still made up of people. And that mm-hmm. was more reassuring and made me feel like at home here than any place I'd ever worked, to be honest.
Yeah, actually, after my PSA about mean tweets online harassment hit, same thing. The next day, John Skipper called me on his cell phone to talk about it and how he wanted the company to be on the forefront of trying to make things better. So you're right. There is much more of a connection there than you might think from afar or even within the company, thinking how big it is. All right, well, so we've got a bit of your background, and you go on, as I said, to the New York Times and the Washington Post. You covered the Knicks and NBA Finals, World Series, Super Bowls, all sorts of stuff. When you get a call to leave the Washington Post to go to this new idea of the undefeated, what is your first reaction to the idea and to the offer of being playing a big role in a site about race, particularly as a white man?
Well, that's a great question. I was hired in the Jason Whitlock era of the Undefeated, which was
the good old times,
shall we say,
right? The good old days.
Shall we say a work in progress?
Yes.
And so at any rate, Jason called me up because I auditioned for some FS1 show that was going to feature Andy Roddick and all these guys, and he was one of the people prospective show I auditioned for, and then he says, hey, look, this contract thing's not going to happen. I think I'm going to join ESPN. And he calls me up like 2 weeks later, and he says, hey, you want to be the one white dude on my black website? and that was his pitch. And I said, all right. After I stopped laughing, I go, what's up, man? And he's like, well, look, man, I've been reading some of your stuff. You've been writing a lot of social stuff. You're not afraid to write race, and you don't run away from it when black, white, Asian, Native American people come at you and want to have a conversation about it. And you're also interested in these other social issues, and you show some strategic advocacy in your work. Like, I like that, man. I'm about that. And so, I really like to think about hiring you. And I said, that's awesome. And I went from really exciting new change that, was very unstable, but still you're working for ESPN. And I felt like, everything, the site wasn't launching. We had all these problems that were well documented. And all I kept thinking was, man, I got to pick another lane to run in. And then it went from I felt like I was one of the most, unstable places at the company to, shoot, Kevin Meredith from the Post got on and just turned, is such a consensus builder. And we ended up getting more people and really talented people,
yeah.
Not just,
really
their bodies,
lineup.
But really talented, smart, like this incredible mix of old and young, who were just great journalists who happened to be black, who happened to be African American or Asian. I mean, so all of a sudden, I'm in this room and I just feel like I don't feel like a minority. I just feel like a part of the Undefeated. The conversations we have around race in there, nothing is off limits. I sometimes wish we could put a camera up and do the sort of, okay, this is what happened in our editorial meeting today, because this was fire right here. We talked about it. And so for me, it's just been like, man, the last year is after the site launched and everything that's happened, not just seeing some of the things I've written and been happy with, but some of the things that other people that I just love them as coworkers. I mean, this is the thing. After I got Bob Lee's Outside the Lines episode talking about that abuse stuff, about 10 members of the site lined up to hug me. I mean,
wow.
it was emotional. I almost get emotional about it now, thinking about it. I mean, they hugged me more than my family did the last 40 years. And I was like,
yeah.
Wow, this wasn't just a regular work environment. So I don't know, maybe because, I don't know, I like, but I, every now and then I'll get a tweet back, like, Like, I'll be I was talking to Kerry Champion one day about the undefeated 50 black athletes coming up, and I got a couple of tweets from people like, why in the hell would I, you know, want to hear from you, a white guy, about this?
Right. And right. I'm like, sure you get that all the time.
Like, how do I respond to that? If you can't give me a chance and you don't believe that I have the social conviction or the, like, that's, you know, I get it, you know, but it is, you know, sometimes it's hurtful, but whatever. I mean, I get it. It's part of the deal, and it's you know, it's what you go through sometimes.
Right. I think it's interesting to be in that position because I just was in it myself, where as a woman who understands that it is a necessity to have male allies in the fight against sexism, we will not get anywhere if it is only women in this fight, right? So I embrace every single man who jumps on board and wants to fight for equality and considers himself a feminist, which really just means equality for men and women, and that's all that means. So when I feel like I am speaking as an ally for people of color, because I understand what it's like to be a marginalized group, if there's pushback to that, it can be really hurtful. And I imagine you would feel the same way. I mean, in the same episode, I'm talking about Kaepernick and everyone is yes, yes, yes. And then I say, I think that people who want to excuse away all of LeVar Ball's flaws by holding him up as the paragon of male black fatherhood, that is a low bar to set. And there are plenty of great male black fathers that are doing amazing things. You can talk about his flaws and you can also like that he's there for his kids, but to hold him up and refuse to acknowledge his issues because you want him to be this ideal is problematic. And it fits into every BS stereotype about black fatherhood. And then instead I get a whole rush of people saying, I'm not allowed to speak on that. And I understand the frustration of somebody speaking on something that you may not think is their purview. But at the same time, isn't it useful to have allies that are saying these stereotypes are whack and wrong and let's not reinforce them? And I'm sure you get the same thing. And how do you deal with that at the site every day? Because I can't imagine how many people I've had be like, isn't the guy at the Undefeated a white guy? And I'm like, yeah. He is.
I mean, I don't know. Like, people always say, what do you identify? Like, I identify as human. Like,
right,
you know,
right.
what do you identify as? But I just, I just think that I don't get caught up in it because I just feel like we're doing good journalism. I mean, I've been committed to newsroom diversity, but what is that really? What is that? Is that hiring somebody of color, a person of color, or a person of, the female gender and breaking up the old boys club? Or is it really giving those people opportunities and not putting them in a corner and saying, wow, we think you're talented and we want to hear your voice too? And so I don't know, you know, how do I deal? I mean, I don't know. I've sabotaged myself a couple of times. I wrote this, basically after the N-word thing got real big between the Dolphins a few years ago, I wrote this thing like, look, I don't like this word. And, you know, I have a kid, so I have a seat at the table. I don't like the word. But, you know, at no point did I say, black people, you can't use the N-word. I said,
right.
I'd like this word to be off the table for everyone. And, like, it would be great if it was. But I also get it. If you're a person who's oppressed by that word for centuries and you want to co-opt that for your own personal agency, whether it's, you know, whether it's Dr. Dre or any hip-hop company or anybody, that's fine. I just don't expect me to, like, not hear it and not cringe sometimes.
Right.
Because I said it once. I can be honest. No one will ever come forward and say, hey, that Wise, he's like Mike Vermin. He said, no, I said it once in my life. I was 5. I came home and told my dad, sang my dad a song. I go, Dad, I learned this song at school. Daniel Boone was a man, was a big man, but the bear was bigger, so he ran like a... And before I got the GGR out of my mouth, he smacked me as hard as he could, and he said, I never want to hear that word in my house again. That is the worst thing you can call a black person.
Right.
We have friends who happen to be black. We have friends who happen to be Asian. We have... Because you do not use it. And that's my... That was my, in my neural cortex there, that's what I know about the N-word. And, you know, it's so like that. So for
right.
me, it's like, it's something that I don't like hearing. It's
right. Just, but you also, know, like, and you said, you understand if some people want to reclaim it and
right.
if that, then that's
right.
their prerogative. But
yeah. And I think you have to be very careful. And I'm sure you dealt with this, like the whole thing of like, you're telling a person who's been through life experiences, you can't imagine how they have to be. And you like you can have opinions about it, but to like, there's just certain things. I'm never, I experienced racism in Hawaii, but I never I'm never going to experience that kind of racism over here, like where I'll never go to a neighborhood and get a home loan and have it rejected and have to wonder why maybe these people didn't want me moving in the neighborhood, or I'll never have to like stand on a corner in Central Park with an immaculate suit and be passed up for someone that's another color than me. You know, because, you know, they're worried that I'm going to do something. Like, I know this never going to happen to me, so I can't. Yeah. But I'm with you on the LeVar Ball thing. Like, my whole thing with LeVar Ball is, like, why can't you celebrate a guy for being in his kid's life and being the kind of father that obviously he was to these kids, and also now say, okay, these kids are turning into adults. Get out of their lives and knock off the misogyny crap, because that makes you look really small and just an awful person. So, like, I'm saying, like, hey, you, there's obviously a lot of good qualities to you, sir, but you're right. Anybody in our business that discounts the negative stuff, the stay in your lane to Kristen Lane, the going off on the female ref, that's like, that's putting your cultural blinders on and saying, that, you know, this is more important. This is more important. Like, why?
Yeah, somebody said to me, he can be a good father and be a misogynist. And I said, no, he can't. You can't raise your kids to think.
That's a very good point.
You can't. Sorry. No. Right. You're raising your kids with a terrible message about women. So it's interesting. Yeah. So I wonder, when you come on as part of the Whitlock group, and that's the person who brings you into the fold, and then that goes terribly wrong and he's out, was there any difficult transition there from the people that came in, whether it was Kevin or anybody else, or was there any even consideration of the people that Whitlock had brought in not being kept on when that transition was made?
I always wondered if there was on top, like, were we going to be sort of identified as the Whitlockians or whatnot, and for a while, because the site went launch, it was like the island, I always called the island of misfit toys, like everybody's trying to get published. I think I got a couple stories, but they were, you know, buried in ESPN.com, and nobody really knew what the Undefeated was. And so all these things were conspiring, you know, against us. And then all of a sudden, I don't know what it was, but, you know, I'll give Marie Donahue credit. I'll give John Skipper credit. People that are ahead of the, you know, Marie Donahue was head of the division in 30-30. All these people that were involved in it up above, their whole mindset became, you know, these guys are the original seven, and they've been through hell, and then we told them we were going to give them these exciting careers, and they haven't been a part of it. And they just, I mean, it sort of like started from ground zero. Like, we had great stories to tell, but the bottom line was, you know, we were given a chance to prove ourselves like anybody else. And, you know, I'm happy to say that everybody that was hired there as, you know, a person, a writer or an editor or whatever, is still working at the Undefeated, and the only guy that left is a guy that went and worked for Eric Rydholm at his new venture. And so, like, to me, it's just like, I don't know. I'm blown away not only by the fact that we stuck around, but more importantly that the company let us stick around and sort of really made good on a promise when they said, hey, don't go anywhere else. We're going to get this right. And they did.
Yeah. Well, it's been a tremendous success. I find it interesting to watch from our vantage point of ESPNW launching a few years before you guys and what we dealt with in terms of being sort of an auxiliary site to the main ESPN.com, the expectations of what would come from a site that was meant to be for and about female athletes and sports fans. And it feels like while there's certainly always going to be pushback on, well, why isn't there a white BET, you know, the idiotic people like that, it seems like you had a smoother entryway once you got past the initial hiccup for people understanding the purpose of the site. Would you consider it sort of people have accepted the worth of it and what kind of product you're putting out there?
I feel that way. I mean, unless you get into the 50 greatest black athletes survey that we got out today.
That wasn't you guys, though. Blame Survey Monkey, because blame everyday people, because they're terrible. They shouldn't be trusted with anything.
Okay, here's my problem with it. And I wrote a column about it. It's going to come out, whatever, and I killed it, and which you shouldn't do because it's your own site that co-opted Survey Monkey. But my feeling was this, like, you know, 10,000 Americans, you know, we got a cross-section, but think about it. 70% of those 10,000, almost 70% were white. So 70% of white people voted for the 50 greatest black athletes. I don't know. I've got a problem with that.
Well, and also I would imagine that
We had to do it all ourselves. But, you know, I think that people-powered journalism is great for some things. I don't know if it was great for this. That's just my opinion. But, look, the fact that everybody's debating it and arguing it, I mean, maybe, you know, what do they say? Any Q rating is a good Q rating, whether it's bad or good.
Yeah, I also wonder, and I don't know if you reference this in your story since I haven't read it yet, but whether it matters that there's probably skewing younger if there are people who are deciding something on SurveyMonkey, right? And so those people
right.
are going to think that Simone Biles,
Simone Biles is
the top 10 and Gabby Douglas is the top 10. And not that they aren't great, but you're skewed by the fact that you have a lot of young people that are witnessing that in person and have no clue about people that came generations before.
Yeah, I just feel like there's just a learning gap. Like, we need to teach people better. Like, how Tommy Smith and John Carlos and Althea Gibson don't make a list like that is just mind-boggling. But, I mean, think about it. I wonder, I don't want to put the thing on race. It's probably more generational, but Kobe Bryant doesn't make the list. Tiger Woods doesn't make the list.
Right.
Think about that.
Deion Sanders.
The most dominant golfer, obviously one of the top 10 basketball players of all time. And some people put him in the top 5. That's crazy that Kobe Bryant wouldn't make those. But I think it has everything to do with them holding his infidelity and the sexual assault charges that was dropped eventually, but he still settled out of court civilly with the woman in Colorado. I think that Tiger Woods' numerous infidelity and his life basically having a public meltdown. Like, people hold that against him. And they hold that against him still. And I just don't know how you can't. Yeah, how do you not put Tiger in that? Even if he doesn't identify like he's Tablin Asian or he's, I don't care. You got to put Tiger in that list. You know, it's just that you have to.
Well, you're basically the SurveyMonkey folks, and you now in reading it are discovering the same issues that happen with the Hall of Fame, right? Is there a set parameter of only on the field? Doesn't matter about character. It doesn't matter whether they were a good teammate. Doesn't matter if they committed a crime. Like, those things come into play, and that clouds the view of people who are voters for the Hall of Fame just as much as the everyday person. And so that makes it so hard for those lists. And that's also why it makes them good fodder for discussion, right? Because nobody's ever going to agree on it, especially when you leave out big names like that. What's the next big...
Go ahead. I was going to say that the undefeated, like, what's your point about the undefeated, whether it's caught on, whether people accept it. I think it's still, you know, whatever the undefeated is now, it could be something completely different in 3 years. The cool thing is, it's almost, we're making it as it goes. We got this huge canvas, and some things we try don't work, and other things are just like, wow, man, that just got traction. And a lot of the stuff that gets traction are the real journalism pieces that we put some time into. And so I just feel like people will know us more. I think the challenge is, like, what are we going to be in 3 years? Like, can we think ahead constantly and go, this is now an interesting story, and the story that we did 3 years ago is good, but it's not for now. You know, I think the worst thing we could do is fall into any familiar patterns.
Well, that's what I was going to say is, you know, ESPNW has become also in some ways a voice for LGBT people and looking ahead to the next step, which is a lot of trans issues. And we've sort of just become a site where a lot of that is covered because of our feeling of being in a similar position to trans athletes as far as being female athletes and acceptance. And that's sort of the next big discussion point that we feel is going to be in sports is, where do they fit in? What are the guidelines and rules by which we can decide where they compete? And all this stuff, especially as it becomes more commonplace and more accepted that trans people are everywhere and they should be able to participate just like anybody else. What do you think is the next big question when it comes to race and sports?
To me, it's will white billionaires get it through their thick head that a character flaw isn't speaking out against something you think's wrong in society. A character flaw is hitting a person that you're in a relationship with. It's bringing disrepute to the league in 20 other ways. and your talent just shouldn't overcome that. I think the Colin Kaepernick thing really has me thinking a lot about, like, really, I'm not saying the guy is great. I'm not saying, like, but the idea that he can't fit in anywhere and that other people are hired, but, and you know what it's about. Like, are we really at the point where, like, a guy can't have a protest against something? And, you know, like, that's crazy to me.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a very specific issue for now. But what it speaks to is two larger issues. One is, will ownership in professional sports remain primarily dominated by white billionaire men, which is something right. looking ahead is a storyline, of course. And then secondarily, and connected to that, is not specific to Kaepernick, but a larger picture of will people push back on the status quo of that ownership level being the ones who make the decisions on what is and isn't okay. Because like I said before, it is as much an agenda to accept that it is their right not to hire Kaepernick as it is an agenda to push back on that and say, we as fans will not accept that the standard operating procedure of talent wins out, even if you're a dog murderer, wife beater, multi-time criminal, all of a sudden stops being the case when it's someone who protested a big social issue that goes against the right-left politics and is offensive to potentially the GOP supporters that are likely to be populating that upper level of management, right? Like, if we decide that it's just their right not to hire them, at what point do the majority African-American players in that league and potentially other leagues decide that they have more power than they might think? It's interesting.
Hey, look at the NBA. I mean, look at the NBA
incredibly
right now.
Progressive.
Guys are essentially, they're superseding, their decisions are superseding many general managers' decisions.
Yeah.
Because they've decided to do certain things, and they wield a certain amount of cachet that obviously they can wield and other people can't when you have a 53-man roster. But look, these players have all kinds of leverage. If they wanted to change the name of Washington and the union really came up out against it, they could do it. But they, you know, that's not a fight they're interested in.
Right.
Because they're also not Native American.
Yeah, that's part of it. And it's also that the careers are shorter. There are more people willing to take your job. And,
right.
You know what I mean? If your window is X amount, you don't want to give up a year. In the NBA, you give up a year, it's not as big of a deal as giving up a year in the NFL. And there's more players at lower levels that are going to miss out on any opportunity that they might have versus on the NBA level. So it gets complicated for sure, but I do think that there's something to be said for understanding that the power dynamics that have existed forever could be changing in ways that will reflect society more as opposed to just the same, you know.
You put that really eloquently. I think the other thing is, are we going to get to a point where race especially, when we talk race, are we going to get to a point of civility? Are we ever going to come back to the civility where we can have a conversation and it doesn't get ugly, social media, 140 characters, I'm going to sun you,
right.
I'm going to go off on you because I don't agree with your point of view. Like, the fact, like, somebody said the other day, it was Morgan Moody, this woman I work with, she said, if you're only talking to people that are your age, you're not helping yourself.
Yeah.
And I believe that way about race too. Like, if you're only, or people, like-minded people, if you're only talking to people that are like-minded, I don't care if you're dyed-in-the-wool Republican or you're dyed-in-the-wool left, you know, you're lefter than Michael Moore. Like, if that's all you're talking to, that's all you're hearing from, those are the only conversations you have, like, we've got no shot.
Sports. That's everything. And that's where we're headed, right? Which is this confirmation bias bubble where you have an echo chamber of people who agree with you and people don't have conversations, don't try to meet in the middle. And so much of that is fostered by the fact that it's done online. It's texting, it's internet, it's whatever. And we don't then get our physical cues from our body telling us you're upsetting somebody or you're not reading, you're connecting. Like, when you interact with someone in person, you try to find points of connection. When you do it online, there is no desire for that. And that's why it becomes this screaming back and forth with no actual conversation. And that's way beyond sports, right? That's where we're headed with everything, which is really scary. I could talk to you forever, but Ali, you know what time it is.
Didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
That's right, the Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects it. Number one, what's the natural talent you wish you were gifted with?
Singing.
Everyone says singing.
If I could be Bono or shoot, you know.
Yeah.
Shoot, even, I don't know. I mean, yeah, if I could be somebody, that Adele or Beyonce, if I could sing, man, oh, my life would have been crazy, Sarah. I would have been rocking it. I would have been freaking it.
Well, sticking with music, number two, what's your Desert Island album? You can only have one.
Desert Island album. Oh, man, that is such a tough one.
Got to go with your gut.
Oh, God. One, okay. I'm going to go with, this is Cheeseball, Journey Escape album.
Wow, wow. Okay, yeah, that is a little Cheeseball, but hey, if you're on an island, escape seems like a good motto to go by. Number three, if you could switch.
You got to be playing Don't Stop Believing every
day.
Yeah,
exactly.
Like,
that's, yeah.
Me off.
Totally. Number three, if you could switch lives with anyone for a day, who would it be?
Bono.
Yeah, see, like, that would be amazing. Look out at the stage, you know, see the fans going crazy.
Yeah, I mean, just not only that, but, like, the guy, you know, in his office, there was a hilarious Onion headline where, like, it was because he's always doing these social activism things and trying to save the world in his spare time. It's sort of like, Bono's band members angry, you know, and there's a quote from The Edge in there, which was made up, of course, like, hey, can you stop freaking saving the world and get back to playing music?
Right. Yeah.
Like
yeah. So you get the balance.
Like, but I just like that he's connected and he, you know, he uses his gift for something more than just riches and fame and all the good feelings that you get on stage.
For sure. Number four, what's the most scared you've ever been?
Boy, I gotta say the night, the day that I fell into the canal.
Yeah.
I mean, the day I fell in the canal, I mean, that moment where I looked up and I realized my dog is, I don't know how she's going to get home tonight. And I'm not getting out of here. And my body was freezing up and I had stage two hypothermia. And I was like, if someone didn't come along, I was convinced that I was going to freeze to death in that water.
Yeah.
And that's obviously most scared I've ever been.
Number five, what has been your biggest failure?
My biggest failure, gosh, you know, like, professionally, I should have asked for Rosario Dawson's number at the Super Bowl party, because I'm not kidding, she was totally hitting it off me, and like, we talked for like a half hour, just me and her, and you know, I'm thinking, at that point, I'm, you know, 30 pounds lighter. But the trouble was, I did have a really special person in my life who didn't deserve me, obviously, at that point. But she's like, at one point, I said, you want me to, like, can we do, like, a lunch thing? Like, the New York Times has a go to lunch with. I could do something like that. She goes, that's great. And she, and so at one point, like, I'm just really shy. And I go, should I call your PR person or your publicist? And you go, yeah, sure. And she gives me this name. And then all of a sudden I go, or should I ask for your number? And she goes, well, she had this big smile. And she goes, you didn't ask for my digits. And I just froze and I didn't know what else to say.
And then you didn't get them?
She wanted me to ask for her digits. And I never did. I never went to lunch with her. But you know what? It was for a reason.
There you go.
I'm out of her league. I mean, she knew it, and I knew it. It's just, that's where and then the other one is the radio show I did in D.C. I never thought, like, the co-host, one of them was a great guy, but we just didn't hit it off. And I just let somebody else have control over my career, put me with people that, you know, and this one guy that was a producer should have been the co-host. He was really smart. And at any rate, I didn't put all that I could into that show. And
yeah.
I should have never taken a four-hour show with a newspaper column. I probably should have taken no more than a three-hour, probably a two-hour show, and I probably should have told them that from the beginning. And if they couldn't do it, I should have done something else because it took me away from a book project that I really wanted to do. And I don't know. It's just, oh, well.
Number six, what habit or quality do you think has contributed most to your success?
Empathy.
Yeah,
you know, I don't care
one.
Who it is, what you've done, I feel like if I can't put myself in your shoes, I can at least try to think about what it's like to be there. And you know, that's obviously from some of my own life stuff. But more than that, just kind of looking at people as a blank slate and not trying to judge them as, you know, you walk in. Like Mitch Albom said this once, and I really believe it, whether you like him or dislike him, I really think he was onto something. So the worst thing you can get into in this business is groupthink. Like going into a press box and deciding, everybody deciding around them that Barry Bonds is the worst person on earth.
Right.
And then nobody going to talk to Barry Bonds. Now, he might be, but if you don't have that personal experience with him yourself and you don't try to get to know him, then you're no better than anybody else. And I think that groupthink is a dangerous thing in this profession.
I totally agree. So, and that's why you need a diversity of voices and people with different experiences and takes. And, yeah, it's much richer that way, for sure. Number seven, what's the thing about yourself you'd most like to improve?
Well, my hairline, but I can't do that. But I think, oh, gosh, I think I just like to, I like to get muscle, you know, I like to get muscle memory going when it comes to writing long stories. Because I'm really good at, like, writing, like, 1,000-word columns. But for some reason, long-form stories, I obsess over them. And, like, the cathode ray from my computer looks at me like a monster in the corner of the room, and I don't want to look at it. And so, like, oh, man, I obsess over them, too. I take too long to write them. But that's what I say. Write better long stories.
Faster. That's a good one. And finally, number eight, what three words would you most hope people would use to describe you?
Three words. Compassionate. And good dad.
Compassionate and good dad?
Yeah, that's three, right?
Yeah, those are pretty good.
Compassionate, good dad. I think that those would be the three.
Those are very good.
I think that would be right.
And so was this conversation. I really appreciate it. So enjoyed talking to you.
Thanks. You got me going to a lot of places I never thought I'd go. And
well, thank you for taking us there.
Oh, and another thing.
This week's edition of That's What She Read is from The Atlantic. It's called Have Smartphones Destroyed a Generation by Jean M. Twenge. And it's from the September 2017 issue. I'll read you just a small portion and recommend that you go read the whole thing. It's a tough read, but it's useful for all of us, not just the very young among us, to understand if we have an addiction and if we are being led to certain behaviors because of our cell phones. And it's especially notable in today's youth because they've never lived without that. And this is what she said about discovering that difference in the youth of today versus previous generations. I've been researching generational differences for 25 years, starting when I was a 22-year-old doctoral student in psychology. Typically, the characteristics that come to define a generation appear gradually and along a continuum. Beliefs and behaviors that were already rising simply continue to do so. Millennials, for instance, are a highly individualistic generation. But individualism had been increasing since the baby boomers turned on, tuned in, and dropped out. I had grown accustomed to line graphs of trends that looked like modest hills and valleys. Then I began studying Athena's generation, and Athena is a young girl that she talks about earlier in the story. Around 2012, I noticed abrupt shifts in teen behaviors and emotional states. The gentle slopes of the line graphs became steep mountains and sheer cliffs, and many of the distinctive characteristics of the millennial generation began to disappear. In all my analyses of generational data, some reaching back to the 1930s, I had never seen anything like it. At first, I presumed these might be blips, but the trends persisted across several years in a series of national surveys. The changes weren't just in degree, but in kind. The biggest difference between the millennials and their predecessors was in how they viewed the world. Teens today differ from the millennials, not just in their views, but in how they spend their time. The experiences they have every day are radically different from those of the generation that came of age just a few years before them. What happened in 2012 to cause such dramatic shifts in behavior? It was after the Great Recession, which officially lasted from 07 to 09 and had a starker effect on millennials trying to find a place in a sputtering economy. But it was exactly the moment when the proportion of Americans who owned a smartphone surpassed 50%. You can go on and read the rest of the story, which talks about the ways in which today's youth have vastly different behaviors. They're safer because they go out less and they involve themselves in less risky behavior physically, but there is a serious risk of mental health issues. And the statistical portrait of this smartphone generation shows they're hanging out with friends less. They don't care as much about learning how to drive a car. They're dating less. They're having less sex. They feel more lonely. They don't sleep as much. All of these behaviors that are drastically changing that psychologists and parents are going to have to figure out how to deal with in ways that no generation has before. It's a fascinating read, and I highly recommend it. Thanks, as always, for lasting about an hour with me.
That's what she said.